Welcome to Halal Money Matter, sponsored by Saturna Capital. I'm Monim Salam. You know, the topic we're going to be talking about today is going to be about international investing. People always talk about international diversification. They talk about why it's important. And especially living in the current times, it's really a better way to understand how your complete asset allocation works with international stocks in them or funds. Dan Kim is joining us today. He is a chartered financial analyst and the director of research and portfolio manager here at Saturna Capital. He joined us about 2 years ago, roughly, and has some really extensive experience running his own company called Black Queen Capital. There, he was managing a global investment firm, and also he did this right all the way up to when he was joining Saturna. He obtained his bachelor's degree from Cornell University, where he studied operations research and industrial engineering, with a concentration in electrical and computer engineering. What a handful. He then attended Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management, where he earned a master's in financial engineering. I'm really excited to have him on the call. And so let's get started. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Monim. Great to be here.
Great. So, I mean, right off the bat, I kind of talked about it in my introduction. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, global investing versus international investing, or just investing in your local country.
Yeah, absolutely. So global equities management, essentially what it does is it gives the investor or the manager the full spectrum of being able to allocate to U.S. equities as well as international. So you're kind of leaving that allocation decision up to the investment manager. Now, as a U.S. investor, it's called a familiarity bias, but essentially investors, both institutional as well as individual, we tend to have a very large indexing to U.S. North American equities. And so I would say just eyeballing, you know, maybe about 10% or even less of normal accounts will even have an international dedicated weighting versus roughly, you know, 35-40% of the global market cap is international. So that's a pretty big misalignment in terms of allocating your wealth accordingly.
So I guess what you're trying to say is that, you know, if you're just investing in regular mutual funds and have just a U.S. exposure, you're really losing out on about 35% opportunities that might be there across the world. So for example, in Europe or in Japan, something along those lines, right?
Absolutely. So, you know, because of that over-indexing to start with as a U.S. investor, if you choose to go with a global strategy, then you're kind of double counting yourself because that global strategy is going to have a pretty big U.S. weighting in itself. So.
Okay. And then the international part of it, that just basically means that there's no U.S. exposure at all?
Exactly. That's the benchmark. Although you can give your manager, and a lot of active strategies do this, but if there's a very strong opportunity and it happens to be in the U.S., then that international manager has the ability to you know, on the edges, go off benchmark and capitalize on those U.S. opportunities as well.
Okay. So then I can understand somebody who's in an emerging market or maybe somebody who's in Europe and they want exposure to the U.S. because of like a lot of the large cap, you know, companies are here. But why would a U.S. investor want that exposure international?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess the most obvious topic that's discussed is valuation. U.S. equities are simply much more expensive from a sort of apples to apples comparison versus international stocks. Now, you know, one can say, well, U.S. equities have always been at a premium to international stocks, and that's valid. But if you look at a historical time series of this data, we're pretty much near record levels in terms of this premium. I mean, U.S. equities were at one point on par, so equivalent in terms of valuation to international stocks. But right now, as of the end of June, this premium has gotten as high as 62%. I wrote an article on international equities about a year and a half ago. And at that point, it was really high at 45%, but it's just gone straight up since then. And it got to a high of roughly 78-79% earlier in the year, And so it's actually come down quite a bit. That's part of the reason why international stocks have outperformed significantly its U.S. peers. But essentially, if you're only investing in U.S. stocks, of course, we have very high quality companies here. But why would you choose to restrict your investment opportunity set? If you allow your manager to have the global universe of equities and really just cherry pick the top names in the US as well as globally, you're just giving that investment manager the ability to have a larger, a full opportunity set of stocks to work with. And, of course, we have fantastic companies here, but there are fantastic world-class category leaders in the international markets as well. And generally speaking, of course, every case is different. You can get these world-class companies at a significant discount to very similar exposed companies here in the U.S.
Let's talk a little bit more about, in the current environment. As you mentioned, although it's only been 6 months, the international markets have significantly outperformed the U.S. Part of that has to do with Trump's announcements on trade, the things that are going on in the U.S. Kind of talk a little bit about why you think over the next 5 or 10 years that you do feel the international markets or ex-U.S. markets are going to do better.
Yeah, well, certainly from a currency perspective, you mentioned this, but the dollar through a lot of these actions, these measures that have been taken pretty deliberately, the dollar's down something like 8.5% year to date. And that's a significant move. If you're a government that holds a lot of U.S. denominated debt, every percentage point of this devaluation can actually make a meaningful impact on your fiscal deficit and your debt holdings. So this is quite positive for those scenarios. Now I would qualify my statement of this enthusiasm for international markets slightly in that I think it's more important than ever if you want to have international exposure to be active in your investment strategy, because international markets economies, they have a ton of positives and pros, such as valuation, being able to capitalize on world-class companies. But there is a flip side where, I think ex-US growth has been lagging and will probably continue to lag if you just get a broad sort of index exposure of the entire markets. And so I think it's more important outside of the U.S. to be able to really be able to pick and choose which sectors, which types of companies, what countries you're going to choose to get into. But if you have that ability, again, you can match the same caliber of quality of companies. You can generally get stronger earnings growth, and you can get a discount relative to very similarly exposed peers in the U.S. That's why I, even over a long-term period, am quite positive on active exposure in the international markets. Again, from a currency perspective, through, whether it's deliberate or policy-driven or not, I think the current administration is quite happy having a very weak currency. They're not taking direct intervention actions. But certainly through the measures that they've been taking with tariffs, with that sort of aggressive stance against certain countries from an economic perspective, it is having an impact on the dollar.
I think Trump actually has said a few times that he'd like to see the dollar weaker than it is right now. So he's basically forecasting what exactly he wants to do over the next 3 or 4 years.
So he's basically, in a way, intervening. Yeah. Without directly intervening by causing all this volatility and chaos in the markets. And he's kind of getting what he wanted anyways, because a weak U.S. dollar, it's actually quite positive from an economic perspective. And it's actually something I don't think enough investors are talking about, but I call it export elasticity. And what I mean by that is, for every percentage point that your currency weakens, like the dollar weakens, not all U.S. exports are made the same. There's the standard sort of physical manufactured products, There are services. So U.S. has like a, I don't know, like a $300 billion service export surplus. And then there's technology exports. And so it turns out, which obviously the U.S. has a heavy exposure to, so technology exports for every unit of decrease, the elasticity is actually like 1.4 to 2. Services, that sensitivity is 1.2 to about 1.5. And the least impacted is this sort of physically manufactured products, which is I think it's like a quarter or less of all of the U.S.'s exports. And so essentially what I'm saying is for every percentage point of U.S. depreciation, you're getting a much bigger bang for the buck in terms of services and this technology that we export to other countries. And so I think that's kind of contributing to this resilience. And I would imagine the administration is looking at this and, again, doesn't mind at all with this depreciation. And they probably would be happy for another, you know, leg down, which is, I think, what Morgan Stanley is predicting.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's kind of break that down a little bit further. We are talking about the differences in currencies. And so, you know, for if you have, you know, if the currency is depreciating, or as the Trump wants, President Trump wants it to be, then basically, you know, your everyday purchase that you have, you might not see any difference there. But if you had, for example, a holding of an international stock, let's supposing in Europe or in Japan, and, you know, for every, let's say, 1 percentage point, the dollar depreciates, you're actually making 1 percentage points higher on whatever their tin is on the reverse currency, correct?
Exactly. So you just get the immediate benefit from that depreciation with a, you know, presidential administration that's very happy to see that depreciation, which benefits you as an international investor, and will probably continue to have this stance. So it's you're kind of in a good spot from a currency perspective, and from just a global economic perspective, as long as you're not picking the companies that are exporting a ton of manufactured goods into the US, which, you know, there's a lot of. So this, again, this is why it's important to be active. You can really sort of scalp your way into strong returns.
Mm. And the other part of this is, but you can also get exposure to international by investing in U.S. companies. The large caps usually are doing a lot of exporting and those type of things. Are you saying that there's not, it's not a one-to-one ratio of how much benefit there is?
Yeah, that's a great point. And so you're absolutely right. We've got very large multinational companies in the U.S. That do a lot of exporting. The one thing to keep in mind is that even though technically a lot of the revenues may be categorized to go overseas, maybe it's Greater China, Europe, the actual end demand component of where that good that you ship sort of on an intermediary basis to perhaps even China ends up tends to be, in a lot of cases, the U.S. So it looks like you're getting that sort of overseas exposure, but in the end, what you're getting is just U.S. consumption of that finished product after that intermediary country, like a Singapore or Vietnam or even China, will sort of value add upon that and then ship back to the U.S.
You know, you talked about higher valuations in the U.S. than in other parts of the world. And also at one point in time, probably I would venture to guess it was basically in the 2000s that they were almost at parity, the valuations were at parity. And so I don't think it's not that the companies in Europe or other places haven't grown. It's just the U.S. has grown faster over the past 15 or 20 years, for example. Why do you think that trend is not going to continue?
Yeah, you know what? I think it does continue. To be perfectly honest, so I'm not negative on U.S. equities. I like U.S. equities a lot, but, you know, from a relative standpoint, it's absolutely beneficial to diversify your assets and wealth outside the U.S. And especially if you have the ability to not just buy like a blanket strategy that you're just getting all the exposures, good and bad, with this ex-U.S. economy, which I think is probably going to continue to grow at a slower pace. Just because there are some structural issues, but then there are some investment related issues. There's demographic issues that all combine to probably a slower trajectory than the U.S. But does it justify, you know, a 62% premium valuation? I don't think so. I think from a currency standpoint, you're in a favorable starting point, at least. From a valuation standpoint, I mean, we're basically at record highs. It's extremely compelling. And then from, you know, just an innovation catch-up standpoint, the U.S. has been printing out all of this innovation. They've been reinvesting. Their productivity is top-notch right now, and it probably continues to chug along. But if you're in a country that has a demographic problem, especially like maybe Japan or even Europe, and then you have a huge productivity boost from AI, from virtual, you know, software agents that it can essentially replicate human labor. Those countries that have had this chronic structural shortage of labor, I mean, they're probably going to stand to benefit the most on a relative basis. Everyone's going to benefit. The U.S. is going to benefit, but the U.S. is already starting at a point of pretty good efficiency and productivity, whereas it's been a big problem for Western Europe and Japan and Korea, even China. So from a relative net standpoint, the sort of velocity of that improvement, there is a strong case to be made that international markets have a much better ability to generate that delta, that difference in terms of growth differential.
That's a really good point. And then, this is not the first time, by the way, I had you on a podcast, because we actually did a webinar together and then we put that into a podcast. And there were certain things that we were talking about. This happened right after Trump had announced his tariff plans and those things. So there are, as we mentioned, a few of the things that are causing the dollar to depreciate relative to other currencies. We talked a little bit about, you know, the strategy of Trump to be able to just come out and say he wants to lower Drawer. But the other two I wanted to focus on. Number one is going to be just our debt and the deficit that we keep running every single year. How does that play into dollar weakness or dollar strength?
Yeah, well, I think it's been playing straight into the dollar weakness that we've seen. And, it's kind of day by day, but I don't think that narrative is going to change in a meaningful way, and at least in the foreseeable future, partially because the administration doesn't mind a weak dollar at all. And they probably don't mind it getting weaker, as mentioned. And this big bill that apparently has passed in the Senate today. Again, I leave the calculations up to the experts in terms of what it's going to do to the budget. But, you know, clearly the markets are expressing themselves in a way that leads to sort of a weakened fiscal debt situation and directly translating into a weaker dollar. And again, we have to remember, with these tariffs, again, I don't know how it's exactly going to play out. Some people say, you know, the producers like, you know, companies in China are going to take all of the brunt of the tariffs and they're just going to eat it and we're not going to experience anything. You know, other people will say they're just going to pass all that price increase, that tariff on to the US. And so, you know, the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. But there's going to be some impact. Someone has to eat it, and it's going to differ by product. If it's high in demand, then probably the consumer is going to eat it. If it's like very commoditized, then probably the producer eats it. But whatever happens, we're going to eat it in some extent. But then again, with this decline of, you know, 8%+ in the currency, I mean, think about it. There's a tariff that's slapped on what we import, and our dollar is, you know, 8-9% weaker. So that's like a double whammy that we're experiencing right now. And so it's definitely kind of that we're taking the pain up front. And so I'm kind of cringing and hoping that it's not too bad. Eventually, it's going to lead to a very nice sort of shift in terms of the trade dynamics, in terms of our deficit. As I mentioned, we're heavily exposed to these very elastic areas like technology and exports that we export. And that's going to be fantastic for those companies' revenues. But that's kind of in the medium term. The short term, it is kind of scary. And so I think markets, FX traders, institutions are kind of showing where they stand right now. It's leading to sort of this weaker dollar every day type of news flow. I don't think that shifts around. Again, over the medium term, if U.S. growth turns out to be much better than expected because of this, you know, juicing impact from currency, as well as, I mean, it's a big bill, but I mean, it's really stimulative, right? So there is a positive to just pumping, you know, over three trillion of deficit.
Wow.
For us to worry about later. But in the meantime, it is an economic stimulus for sure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the one, you know, savior potentially could be perhaps meaningfully better than expected economic activity.
Yeah, but that's more, I think, in the short term, because it's a short-term boost, right? In the long term, as the debt gets bigger, there's really what I see is only two ways you can actually get yourself the debt down. Number one is you cut the spending, which we've clearly seen from this bill, that's not going to happen. It's very, very difficult to do politically. Sometimes people call it political suicide if you think you're going to be cutting spending in your own district. But the other way, which people sometimes don't realize, is you can depreciate the dollar out of your debt, or inflate yourself out of it, right? You make the debt worth less than it definitely is now, or you lower the interest rates to a point. That's why Trump's been talking about the Fed lowering rates, or trying to push towards that. And if you do that, then you have more inflation. Inflation leads to a weaker currency, and that's one of the reasons I think that Trump does want to have a lower dollar. Feel free to disagree if you do.
No, that makes perfect sense. And again, kind of just monitoring what policy actions are being taken, that seems to be the path.
Yeah. So now I know you do manage an international fund. And so tell me a little bit about where you're seeing opportunities. Is it geographical? Is it more sectoral based? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so I'm finding value without, again, having to sacrifice quality. Of course, this AI thematic has gone bonkers over the past sort of 18, 24 months, starting with the sort of you-know-who, the who's who in the U.S., largest sort of 7 to 8 stock market. And so those stocks have gotten all the spotlights. And then it's rippled over into the AI derivative plays, like in terms of industrials, and even things like utilities have taken off. But a similar phenomenon is happening overseas, but it's just a bit more delayed, and it's definitely not receiving the same sort of spotlights that the US is. You know, I mentioned, you know, SAP versus ServiceNow, but in other areas, one area I'm looking at in particular is within the AI data center. You can have blazing fast chips and blazing fast networking equipment. So I'm referring to, you know, NVIDIA makes the GPUs, and now Broadcom's making the ASIC sort of accelerators as well, which is kind of comparable. But then you have your networking chips and infrastructure, which Broadcom, of course, also participates in. But then you need the wiring and the cabling to allow this data to essentially be transferred. And if you don't have that capacity, then it doesn't really matter how blazing fast your you know, GPUs and networking chips are. It's just not going to be possible. Either there's too much heat, or it's just, you know, there's too much decayance of the signal. I don't want to get too technical here, but essentially, there are companies, one in particular in Japan, that actually dominates this optical fiber cabling market. They got like a 40% market share, and essentially these newest AI data centers, it's no longer a super nice to have. It's an absolute must have, or else you can't really scale up to these, you know, fastest speeds and networking architecture. And so, you know, this is a company that's trading at 21 times going to 18 times versus, you know, U.S. peers are trading in the 40 to 50 to 60 times earnings range. And again, I'm not sacrificing. These guys have 40%. I mean, they pretty much own the market in an oligopoly. And they're really the one of the most exciting bottlenecks in this whole AI thematic. So this is not an AI derivative. This is actually an AI accelerant, which is actually allowing this thematic to actually move along and to accelerate.
Are you usually demographic? I mean, did you look at regions of the world, whether it be Europe or Asia versus South America? Are there some likes and dislikes that you have?
Well, I'm pretty agnostic when it comes to, countries or regional exposures. For the longest time, the Japanese economy was like the worst possible, economic region on the planet. And I most of my portfolio was in Japan, because I didn't really care. I mean, as long as I was finding, very unique idiosyncratic companies that had their own story going on, that had a nice, double digit trajectory on top line, with a sort of secular tailwind elsewhere, it didn't really matter. Right now, I am focused probably more on the sort of infrastructure, AI, industrial space, just because I'm finding more of those types of names fit into my sort of investment architecture. But from a regional standpoint, I do like what has happened in Japan. I think Korea is probably going to go through a similar sort of transformation. It's probably not going to be an overnight thing. But those are a couple areas I like. I do like parts of Europe. I think the region probably has some upside in terms of more stability, hopefully, going forward, and a reinvestment cycle that has just kind of been lacking for the last 15 years, especially after the European debt turmoil that we saw in the sort of early 2010s. I think there's some significant exposure there. And again, not to harp on tech, but, not because they've done a fantastic job, but because they've underinvested, because they've not sort of migrated to the cloud like the US peers were doing, that now they need to accelerate. If you want to roll out AI, you need to first reconstruct, digitalize your infrastructure to the cloud so that you can properly take advantage of AI.
So, I mean, we've been fairly positive about investing internationally and talking about this. What do you see as some of the risks of an investor putting money abroad?
Yeah, no, big time. It's there are plenty of risks. And again, this is why I don't know if I would just put my money in a broad index, having exposure to all of the European and global economies, because, again, these structural issues with Europe, China, Japan, Korea, huge demographic issues, and it's probably going to get worse over the next decade. Shortages in skilled labor is pretty bad in Europe. There's been a underinvestment cycle in infrastructure and in technology and innovation in Europe, over the last 10, 15 years. China has had a massive, their property market just blew up like really badly about a year and a half ago. It looks like it's stabilizing, but it's a bit of a hole they need to dig out of. And so I think youth unemployment there is it's in the upper teens. It's quite bad there. And these aren't issues that can just kind of flip on a dime and recover. So they're definitely starting at a difficult spot to be able to quickly catch up to other peers. So those are definite risks that I see. It's great to see, hopefully, a more sort of calm Middle East environment from a geopolitical standpoint. There's a ton of negative geopolitical uncertainty that seems to just not really want to go down at all. And so who knows? Time will tell what happens. But there can definitely be casualties from all this. And some economies are not as equipped. They're not in a strong economic positioning to be able to withstand the storm.
So now, I mean, I know you manage a fund, which is it's a conventional international fund. As a Muslim investor or an investor who wants to have, a portfolio aligned with Islamic principles, how do they get access to the international markets?
Yeah, I think international markets is actually a great playing field for halal investors in terms of, looking for companies that don't take a lot of debt. They're not speculative, high quality, high cash flows. I mean, this is kind of the DNA of what we go for. as a firm, investment firm itself, you know, not only for the Hawal dedicated strategies, but from an overall DNA perspective. So, you know, I know there's a ton of US stocks and companies that have these characteristics, but from an international setting, again, because we don't need to really sacrifice quality, we're able to have more than enough of a candidate pool of a universe to be able to deploy this and actually differentiate even more relative to a lot of other companies and constituents in these overseas markets relative to the US. And this is partially why, back to the active versus passive theme, active managers internationally have consistently been able to outperform the broader markets. And that hasn't really been the case for US equity active managers. It's been much more difficult for them. And that's really just a reflection of there's just greater uncertainty, as well as international markets are just less efficient. I don't want to say anything negative, but they're just simply not covered as closely with as much rigor and really eyeballs as their US peers. And so that generally tends to situations where there are just more mistakes in terms of analyst projections on things like top line revenues, operating margin forecasts that collectively lead to these, you know, bigger, more juicier opportunities from an international standpoint.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Dan, for your time. Is there any kind of final thoughts you want to share with us before we close it off?
I think we covered a lot. Thank you for that. You know, I like to take a step back and just think about what I'm doing with my wealth. You know, I generally think people should have international global exposure, because if you spend a single dollar on anything, chances are that's going to have some international component to it. So in a way, you're really hedging yourself from a, you know, total wealth perspective. And that's another way to you know, take a step back and kind of look at it from a different perspective.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you taking and explaining to our listeners about international investing and the benefits and the risks there.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Hawal Money Matters. If you like what you hear, please do rate us on the app stores and also leave us a review. It helps other people find us a lot easier.
The thoughts and opinions expressed on Hawal Money Matters do not necessarily reflect the views of Saturna Capital, Amana Mutual Funds, or their affiliates. Please consider an investment's objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. To obtain this and other important information about the Amana Funds in a current prospectus or summary prospectus, please visit amanafunds.com or call toll-free 1-800-728-8762. Please read the prospectus or summary prospectus carefully before investing. The Amana Funds are distributed by Saturna Brokerage Services, member FINRA and SIPC, and a wholly owned subsidiary of Saturna Capital, the investment advisor to the Amana Funds. Investing involves risk, including the risk that you could lose money. The Amana Funds restrict investments to those companies consistent with Islamic and sustainable principles, which limits opportunities and may affect performance. This material is for general information only and is not a research report or commentary on any investment products offered by Saturna Capital. This material should not be construed as an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any security in any jurisdiction where such an offer or solicitation would be illegal. We do not provide tax, accounting, or legal advice to our clients, and all investors are advised to consult with their tax, accounting, or legal advisors regarding any potential investment. Investors should not assume that investments in the securities and/or sectors described were or will be profitable. This podcast is prepared based on information Saturna Capital deems reliable. However, Saturna Capital does not warrant the accuracy or completeness of the information. Investors should consult with a financial advisor prior to making an investment decision. The views and information discussed in this commentary are at a specific point in time, are subject to change, and may not reflect the views of the firm as a whole. All material presented in this publication, unless specifically indicated otherwise, is under copyright to Saturna. No part of this publication may be altered in any way, copied or distributed without the prior express written permission of Saturna Capital.